welcome to Conversations with Consequences. We are the radio show and podcast of the Catholic Association, where we aim to change the culture one conversation at a time. You can listen to Conversations with Consequences on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network, Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. Eastern, or catch the encore at 5 p.m. We are also on Sirius XM channel 130. Of course, our radio show is also a podcast. Go to thecatholicassociation.org or directly to wherever you listen to your podcast. I'm your hostess, Ashley McGuire.
And I'm Mary Fiorito.
And this week, a new coalition was announced with $30 million infused into the pro-life movement. The Life Leadership Conference has been announced with David B. Wright, founder of 40 Days for Life, Princeton Professor Robert George, and Leonard Leo among those taking part. The conference will streamline the works of pro-life organizations and build a coalition of pro-life groups to defend the unborn and to support their mothers. David B. Wright is known for his pro-life work, including founding 40 Days for Life, and he's now the executive director of the Life Leadership Conference, and he joins us now to discuss the importance of working together in the pro-life movement. Welcome to the show, David.
Ashley, Mary, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to have this discussion.
So, David, tell us about the origins of this new network. How did the idea come about? And just tell us its story.
Yeah. So really, this has been the culmination of many, many years of conversations, but these conversations have come to an even more focused point over the last 2.5, 3 years since the Dobbs decision, because the pro-life movement has grown very organically. It has so many leaders and organizations at the local level, at the state level, at the national level, and it's an amazing, diverse, rich movement. The problem is, and particularly where this has come to a head in these last 2.5 years, we've not been very organized together. We have had all these different efforts that work frequently in isolation, but we are not working together. And when we are isolated, when we're in our separate silos, it dilutes our overall impact. Why this is particularly important to understand and to address right now is when the Dobbs decision, the United States Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade, they didn't ban abortion. They simply said the decision about abortion now goes back to the American people through our elected officials in the states and in Congress. And as a result, we now have this radically different landscape, 50 state-by-state battles. It's more important ever in this post Roe moment that we get our act together. And so when we look at the landscape and realize that abortion is still the leading cause of death in America, ending more than 1 million lives a year, when we recognize that of the 17 times that abortion has been on various state ballots since the Dobbs decision reversed Roe versus Wade, we've lost 14 of those battles. We see the flood of people going across state borders for abortions, the explosion in the use of abortion pills. It's critical now more than ever that we start to strategically coordinate our efforts, mobilize together, share information, and work together to achieve greater life-saving impact. I think this is something that the time has come for. It's long overdue, and I'm really excited to see all these pieces falling into place at this critical moment.
Well, David, I can't tell you how my heart soared when I saw that statement, because I've been in the pro-life movement for more than 30 years, and 2.5 decades ago, I was asked to be a witness in the Now versus Shidler case, because I was in, when the RICO statutes were being used against people who were pro-life protesters. And I remember, a lot of the basis of those allegations against Joe Shidler were that there was this collusion going on, right, in the pro-life movement. And I remember I used the analogy, and this is not a movie I would recommend for spiritual reasons, but that scene in The Life of Brian, the Monty Python movie, when the People's Front of Judea is fighting the Judean People's Front, and while they're fighting with each other, the Romans come in and kill all of them. I said, that's kind of like what the pro-life movement was at times. You had people with the same goals, practically the same names in some situations, but a lot of the tensions sometimes between groups would be like, well, we're activists and we're the ones that are really saving lives. But then the pregnancy centers were saying, but you have nowhere to send people, women, if you don't have us. So everybody kind of going back to the same well for funding and for support. And it created tensions that never should have existed, right? Between groups, again, who all had this same noble goal. So in what way do you think you can help I guess the high tide raising all boats, right, would be the purpose of this, to help all the groups get the support that they need so that they can work in unison and without friction with each other.
So, Mary, first of all, thank you so much for giving that additional context and for all that you and so many others have done for so many decades in the movement. And this is in no way an indictment of where we've been. It's just a realization that we're in a new landscape. We can't keep operating the way we did prior to the Dobbs decision in this post-Roe America that we're in. And the thing that I think is kind of first and foremost is that groups and leaders have identified this is a need that has to be addressed. When you see states that used to be relatively reliably pro-life enshrining abortion in their state constitutions, you recognize what we've done before isn't going to get us to where we need to be now. So there's this realization that we've got to do something different, but also we've got to do something together. Because just like the church is made up of a body of many different parts, but we have to all be together in the church, right? In the same way, the pro-life movement has all of these rich facets and all of these amazing organizations and leaders and advocates and donors, but we've all been operating in isolation in these different silos. And if we can finally start, now that the need is recognized, now that people realize that we need to do bigger things to achieve bigger wins, if we can have leaders starting to communicate, which is happening actively right now, and I'm so encouraged and enthralled by this, leaders who are talking with one another, they're strategizing, they're mapping out how do we address a challenge when it comes up, when the Donald Trump's White House issues an executive order about IVF, you see pro-life groups suddenly coordinating their efforts and their communications better than I've seen in years. I'm thrilled to see these developments, but these are just early nascent stages. But then also the other piece that I think has been missing, because there have been attempts at collaboration and coordination in the past, and I've been a part of many of those efforts. But the difference is we didn't previously have a bunch of philanthropists coming together and saying, we are going to actually incentivize groups to work together by putting together a pile of money, in this case, a starting pile of $30 million to state groups. If you are willing to say you're going to be best at what you do in your lane, we're going to have others who are best in their lanes, but together let's create a super highway and let's put jet fuel into our engines through this super fund. I think that's going to accelerate our impact beyond anything we've seen up to this point.
You're so right, David. I noticed on Twitter the immediate and not coordinated, but kind of synthesized reaction to the mandate. It actually startled me because I'm just not used to seeing that. And I was very encouraged because, as in the pro-life movement, we know that we can't be cheap dates to this administration. And it's kind of on us to make sure that, what our ideals are carried forward. And actually in the memo that was released with the launch of this organization, the memo wrote that you're going to be working together to ensure the pro-life movement's ideals are fully and faithfully operationalized to the end of winning more and losing and compromising less. What are some of those starting ideals that everybody in the room was able to sit down and agree upon?
Yeah, so a lot of times it begins by establishing what is it that is our shared sense of purpose? Because many different parts, right? We talked about in the church the same way. We also have many different tactics. But as somebody once told me years ago, tactics are many, principles are few. Tactics always change. Principles never do. So we had to say, what are the core principles that we agree upon? What is the end game that we are all working towards? And then to say, there are different tactical ways to get there. And sometimes we can work together on those, and sometimes groups will work independently. So, what are some of the principles? What are some of the foundational things that we agree upon that we need to work towards? So, first, a recognition that we envision a society where every woman who is facing an unexpected pregnancy is supported. And where abortion becomes not only unavailable, but over time unthinkable. That's the end game we're all working towards, where every woman is supported in the midst of an unexpected pregnancy. We have not only the strengthening of those pregnancy centers, maternity homes, but also the wider knowledge and availability of that. A case in point of this, the abortion industry a couple of years ago did a deep study of those who had had abortions and unknowingly revealed that 6 out of 10 women who had had abortions said that if they had known about practical support and help available to them to continue their pregnancy, they would never have had the abortion and they would have preferred not to. Well, we need to fix that. That's part of what the pro-life movement is here for. We need to provide that support and help and make it known to people and strengthen it. Another principle that we all recognize is that every human life has dignity and worth. And for people of faith, we understand that comes from God. We are created in his image and likeness. And so anything that violates that dignity of human life, we look at even Catholic social teaching, the entire bedrock of Catholic social teaching is the dignity of the human person. Everything else comes beyond that. And so we have to start there and recognize that anything that destroys human life, be it in vitro fertilization, be it abortion or even various different contraceptive drugs and devices, we have to recognize what the threats to life are and then to address those systematically. So those are some of the issues that we're beginning to recognize as fundamental principles. And to you mentioned the cheap date. I think that sometimes we have gone into this reactive mode where we just want to have a seat at the table. We just want to be seen as working with people in positions of power. And that's fine, but we also have to recognize that we are here to drive change, not to just react and just ride and get along to go along. So we have to be the ones to advance and champion that dignity of the human person in a loving, in a compassionate, in a winsome way, but to make sure that we don't compromise our own values, our own beliefs while advancing it in the public policy forum or in advocacy and education and social media. We're not doing this just to get a lot of thumbs up and likes and to get politicians stroking us on the back, but instead we're doing this because first and foremost, we're faithful to God. And secondly, we understand that every human life is sacred and needs to be respected and protected.
David, there was a rather extraordinary article in the New York Times a couple of days ago that actually went into detail about abortion injuries that women have been suffering primarily at clinics like Planned Parenthood, which receives, of course, a lot of government funding, and hopefully that's going to be cut off soon. But a number of years ago in Chicago, we had a beautiful young woman named Tanya Reeves who went in for a second trimester abortion at Michigan Avenue's Planned Parenthood clinic. Her uterus was perforated during that procedure, and the staff waited 7 hours to call 911, and she bled to death in the meantime. And there was a settlement. It was a modest settlement, in my opinion, given the fact that she died and left behind smaller children. But these kind of, I know one of the goals of this new effort is to reduce abortions and making them less available. And it seems to me that this is an area where you have doctors, you know, some of whom are not even OBGYNs doing these procedures on women, many times damaging them, and personal injury law firms, unless the woman dies, unwilling to take these cases. And it seems to me that's sort of been an overlooked component, is making women aware that, yes, these can be dangerous procedures. And you should have a voice if you are injured by an abortion provider. And I'm wondering if in any of the things you've discussed, that news that was shared in the New York Times might have made you think of maybe some new efforts that we might undertake.
Absolutely. You know, for a long time, the pro-life movement has recognized that what happens inside Planned Parenthood facilities and abortion centers is terrible, not only for the child in the womb, but also for the mother. But to have the New York Times, certainly no pro-life champion, coming out with this huge bombshell report about the substandard care that's happening at Planned Parenthood facilities mm-hmm. coast to coast, and even reporting these horrific stories about toilets overflowing and for days not being cleaned up and spilling into the procedure room and the stench causing patients to vomit, unqualified medical personnel inserting IUDs unknowingly in women who are pregnant, causing the death of a child. These are horrific situations. So for this to have come out of the New York Times, and for this opportunity we have to be able to say, look, we've been saying for a long time that Planned Parenthood is harmful, that abortion is harmful. You even have those who typically advocate for abortion and for Planned Parenthood who are now recognizing the threat and the harm that is being perpetrated against women and against children. So we need to digest this information, go read that article if you haven't, and then share that article. And even for us to recognize, Mary and Ashley, the opportunities this presents to us. We have right now Planned Parenthood receiving $699.3 million of taxpayer funding. We need to call upon every elected official who's involved in distributing that tax money, point them to the New York Times article, which will have different credibility than if we said, well, here's a great story from EWTN or from a so-called conservative leaning media outlet. No, this is from the New York Times, and say to them, Planned Parenthood's slogan is care no matter what. And yet in the article, it even revealed that their donated hundreds of millions of dollars they received did not go to help women. It was only used to advance legal and political efforts to advance abortion. Taxpayers should never have to fund Planned Parenthood another nickel. And those corporations and foundations and individuals who give to Planned Parenthood thinking they're doing some good need to look in the mirror and say, do I really want to invest in something that's doing this harm to women and children? Or do I want to invest in organizations like pregnancy centers, maternity homes, and those groups that are actually helping women in a time of need rather than hurting them?
It strikes me that the pro-life movement, we really have to be fighting on two levels. And that's why I'm so excited to see your organization or this collaboration coming together, because we have to be playing the long game. And it sounds like that's what this is really about. But, you know, we still have these just kind of immediate hydra of things. Like, who would have thought that after the fall of Roe v. Wade, we'd be in the position of trying to explain that, no, we're not about, you know, treating miscarriages and ectopic pregnancies. What is, so we've got like these immediate issues that we're constantly dealing with, as well as the need to play the long game. What do you see as the most pressing immediate issue that we have to address, like right now, as a movement?
Oh goodness. Yes, that all of it, but let's try to prioritize. And that's something we're actually in the process of doing right now, is looking at the entire landscape, getting an honest assessment of where we are and saying, where can we leverage the immediacy of the fights that we need to take on right now, as well as what is actually the long game of where can we work over time? Because critically, that's got to happen along the way. So I think, first of all, we have to look at the abortion is really an economic drive. You've got the supply side, you've got the demand side or perceived demand. So we have to work to measurably reduce both of those sides of the economic equation. How do we reduce the supply side? By identifying the problems at places like Planned Parenthood, by stripping taxpayer funding, by going in sidewalk counseling outside of these facilities to drive down their customer traffic, by persuading and dissuading their corporate and foundation support from giving to them. Those things will actually drive down the supply side of the equation. But then also, we've got to measurably drive down the perceived demand. And that's where we boost the pregnancy centers and maternity homes. We strengthen and fortify them, increase their capacity, and then expand the awareness, spotlight these amazing organizations and the help that they provide for women. So there are going to always be reactive moments. And in those, another point that I think is important is when you have the pro-life movement made up of thousands, literally thousands of little organizations all over the place, many of them are not messaging experts. And so you have sometimes several thousand different messages going out there. Just to be able to bring together who are the best experts when an issue comes up, bring their expertise together and make that available to the entire movement so we can all talk with credibility, with expertise, and moving in the same direction. That one thing alone, I think, will be game-changing for our ability to interface with the general public, with the media, and to help to tell a narrative that will shift public opinion more in favor of life and more against the abortion industry.
David, one of the other surprises, in addition to having to explain that we don't oppose miscarriage care and treatment for ectopic pregnancies, is the attacks on pregnancy resource centers. More than 300 centers that, you know, Catholic Vote has tracked, firebombings and even worse damage done to pregnancy resource centers. I had the privilege, that's where I first met you, was at the Aid for Women dinner in Chicago. And I've had the great honor of being on their board of directors for many years. How is your initiative here going to help pregnancy resource centers, and will they be prioritized in some way given the attacks on them politically and physically?
Absolutely. Mary, thank you so much. And Aid for Women is an incredible example of what can happen when pregnancy care is approached with excellence, right? Because you have built up pregnancy centers that are serving so many women and making such a difference, and the professionalism, the medical care, everything, it's phenomenal. So yes, that's going to be an absolute central piece of this. In this post-Dobbs arena that we are in, pregnancy support is going to be among the most important front lines for the pro-life movement. It has been for many, many years, but it's going to even take on a heightened importance right now. And we recognize that there's both the strengthening and fortifying these centers by working with groups like Heartbeat International and CareNet and NIFLA and wonderful organizing entities, but also recognizing that the centers they support are many times just run locally by good intentioned people, but to help professionalize and expand the capacity of these organizations. But then there's the defensive pieces of this and bringing the best legal talent, many of whom are already in discussions with the Life Leadership Conference, to be able to defend, protect against these attacks, both the legal attacks in many states like Massachusetts, where you had legislators trying to actively shut down pregnancy centers, and that has been fought back against, and we will continue continue to ramp up those efforts to protect against these legislators, also who need to recognize that when people are told about pregnancy centers, 83% of Americans universally support pregnancy centers and maternity homes. So this is not a political area that we need to get into. This is a support and love and compassion area. And we need to let legislators know who have an abortion agenda and are being funded through their campaigns by the abortion industry, don't go after pregnancy centers. This is the support and help people need if you're truly, quote unquote, pro-choice. And then also, when there is physical violence against these centers, Catholic Vote has done heroic work identifying some of the firebombs and the graffiti and the damage and things like that. We need to aggressively go after the perpetrators of this. We are going after people who pray outside abortion facilities with Biden's weaponized Department of Justice sending them to jail. Many of them just recently pardoned, thanks be to God. We need to, those who are actually doing physical harm, not praying and singing hymns, those who are harming these centers and putting at risk those who work there, they need to be held to account. And so working with enforcement agencies to do this, I think, is going to be a very important piece.
Well, David, we're so excited about this initiative. And where can our listeners learn more about how they can support, pray, follow the work that you all are going to be doing?
Well, we are just in the very early stages. We haven't even yet set up the website and other pieces of this, but I would just say Google Life Leadership Conference in the coming days and weeks. We'll have plenty more information to share. And in the meanwhile, the main thing I would ask is an audience that you have of people of faith, I would beg for your prayers for this effort, because we want this to not be our will. We want this to be God's will, and that we align ourselves and submit ourselves and are guided by Him. Jesus, we trust in you. So we would covet those prayers.
Well, we'll certainly be praying. And in the meantime, we thank you so much for your time and for the wonderful work that you're doing. Thank you, David.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
I'm your hostess, Ashley McGuire.
And this is Betsy Fentress.
And we are happy to have Monsignor Roger Landry with us. He's a member of our TCA team and is now joining us in person every week so we can learn more about his new position as the National Director of the Pontifical Mission Societies. But today, we'd like to talk with him about a new initiative that he is spearheading about Eucharistic adoration as we approach the Lenten season. Welcome back to the show, Monsignor.
Great to be with you, Ashley. Great to be with you too, Betsy.
Monsignor, you penned a beautiful letter to your fellow New Yorkers, and it felt almost like a letter to your fellow man around the world about the importance of Eucharistic adoration within the city's five boroughs. And this is something dear to my heart because I'm so blessed to have moved to a neighborhood where a block away is a church that has daily adoration. It's not 24/7, but it's such a treasure. So tell our listeners about your appeal to your fellow New Yorkers and about Eucharistic adoration.
Thank you very much, Ashley, for bringing it on up. It's dear to me as well, not just because prayer and adoration of Jesus has been essential to my life as a follower of Jesus, not to mention as a priest of the Lord, where I tried to start it in both places. I was pastor in Massachusetts. But I have been, for the last 3 years, a National Eucharistic preacher. I'm one of 56 priests in the U.S. that the bishops of our country have chosen and trained and commissioned to go out and preach about the Holy Eucharist. And so for the last few years, I've been crisscrossing the country trying to promote Eucharistic knowledge, faith, gratitude, amazement, love, and life. And when I come here, and as you know, and the listeners, I think, remember from all the homilies of the previous months, I was for 65 days privileged to carry Jesus across the country from New Haven through New York City all the way to Indianapolis for the National Eucharistic Congress that was taking place there. And so promotion of Jesus in the Holy Eucharist has now become probably the biggest priority that I have as a priest, because I'm convinced that Jesus in the Eucharist is the summit of all salvation history. The most important thing he did was not take on our human nature and enter into our world. The most important thing he did was not just suffer and die and rise for us. He loved us so much that as the new and eternal Passover, he wanted us to feed off of him, to eat his body and drink his blood. And the Holy Eucharist is the way in which he keeps his valedictory promise to remain with us always until the end of time. There are many Catholics who treat Jesus in the Eucharist more as an it rather than the Lord and Savior. That they don't treat him the same way that they would have treated him if they were growing up in Nazareth or they were in Jerusalem 2,000 years ago, that they don't take his real presence as seriously as Jesus wants us to take it. So here in New York City, even though there are 8.1 million people, even though over 30, close to 40% of those here in New York are Catholic, unlike many even rural villages and much smaller cities, we don't have perpetual adoration of Jesus here. There are various parish churches that have some adoration over the course of the day, but it's never worked to have 24/7. Now, a couple years ago, the courageous Dominicans in Greenwich Village, who are at St. Joseph's Parish there, built an extraordinarily beautiful chapel for perpetual adoration. But there's been a problem with people signing up for the 168 hours over the course of the week. So with two of my fellow National Eucharistic pilgrims, Marina Frattaroli and Zoe Dongas, who walked those 65 days with Jesus and me across the country, we hatched this idea of what we're calling Operation Divine Mercy, to try to get everybody else who's not a parishioner there at St. Joseph's to recognize how awesome would it be during this Eucharistic revival, especially as we begin Lent, for us to make perpetual adoration in Manhattan work. And so we're trying to use our creativity, we're trying to use our own schedules and our own commitments in order to take the good efforts there at St. Joseph and bring it over the top. And so we're off to a good start. The National Catholic Register wrote, allowed that letter to be reprinted, which I'm so grateful for. And I'd ask all those who are listening who are within travel distance to New York City to think about helping us out with that. Otherwise, if you're anywhere else, please go to the church closer to you, say hello to Jesus who's there for you, and then pray for the success of this initiative. Because if there's one place in the country that should have perpetual adoration, it has to be the place that St. John Paul II called the capital of the world. And he meant that in a secular setting, but likewise in an ecclesiastical setting. Everybody looks to New York, and we want, when they look to New York, to see a place in which Jesus is being loved and adored full time.
And we're going to take a quick break here on Conversations with Consequences. Stay tuned right here on EWTN Radio. Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. I'm your hostess, Ashley McGuire, alongside my TCA colleague, Betsy Fentress, and Monsignor Roger Landry is still with us.
Monsignor, I know that you wrote in that same letter that you really want to follow the example at Sacré-Cœur in Paris, which has had adoration for 140 years. You wrote 51,000 days and 1.2 million hours. Through two world wars. What a terrific story. I didn't know that. I'm a huge fan and a partaker of Eucharistic adoration every week in my parish. So what do you think it will take to get the people in New York on board with this? Are you also putting notices in all the church bulletins? Are you doing any kind of processions at the beginning of Lent?
So we are reaching out to everyone who can help us. There are various movements of adorers already for certain time periods in their various parishes. We're praising that. We're asking them, could you take on a second to be able to make this work? There's a movement called Hakuna with young adults that has these adoration nights once a month here. We're reaching out to them. I am the chaplain of the Leonine Forum here. This is an initiative likewise in which I've asked all the 200 plus fellows over the last 8 years to assist. We are trying to do everything that we can to bring people with us to Jesus so that he can transform them and through them transform the whole city. So it's all of the above. And if Paris is able to do it with its 2.1 million residents, New York should be able to do it with its 8.1 million residents. And New Yorkers have never been second to anybody in anything, except, of course, sports. They've been second to Boston, but in everything else, New York, shoot for the stars, just like the skyscrapers that surround us here.
And will you just tell everyone about your 8 p.m. Ash Wednesday Zoom call to initiate people into best practices? I can't wait to tune in for that one.
So I'm happy you'll join, and anybody can join. If you go to National Catholic Register, ncregister.com, you'd be able to see the article on this, and there's a link there. But when I was talking to some young adults just trying to troubleshoot why people don't sign up and make a commitment, a few of them said, like, Father, it's not a thing of the will, it's a thing of the head. We're a little afraid to go there because we don't know how to pray for a half hour consecutively, not to mention for a whole hour. That's a little scary. And I said, well, if we did some type of session about best practices for people who have never done it, or upgrade of practices for those who have been regular doors, would that help? And they all smiled and serenely said, yes, that would be incredible. So I looked at the schedule. I have a lot of travel on my schedule upcoming. And I said, well, what about Ash Wednesday? Because it's going to be a Lenten initiative that is part of the Lenten prayer commitment every Catholic's supposed to make. What about making a holy hour once a week at St. Joseph's, where that perpetual adoration chapel dedicated to Divine Mercy is? And so that's when we're going to do it, at 8 p.m. Eastern time on March 5th, which is Ash Wednesday, so that we can all get our Lent off to a wonderful start, no matter where we go to adore the Eucharistic Lord Jesus.
There certainly is something afoot in terms of this revival. I just noticed that at my son's parochial school, where the practice of adoration is not really a part these days, I think, of much of the schedule in a parochial school, that there was a sign out that said every Tuesday is now at 3, right when school lets out, there's going to be adoration. I thought, how brilliant that, you know, kids, I'm in a neighborhood where kids can walk, they can just pop in there and say hello. But one quick logistical question. I noticed in your letter you mentioned that in order for perpetual adoration to work, there's a need for two adorers. Is that like a liturgical rule? Is that a requirement of the church? Is that a security issue? What is that about?
It's a best practice, because sometimes you just have to go to the restroom, right? So the rule is, if you're going to have Jesus exposed, that someone has to be there in front of him. And so to make it work, you need to have two people signed up for every hour. One could be a couple minutes late. One could have a flat tire. But just to make sure there's someone there at all times, you always have two signed up. And so typically for those parishes with perpetual adoration, you need 220 adorers signed on up for at least 1 hour, because many of them will take an hour every day, a fixed hour that they're going to be there at 3 p.m. every day. And so essentially you just try to get to that target number 220, and then it works somewhat effortlessly as you get more people signed up.
Well, I know our listeners can certainly pray for this and pray for it in your own parishes and your own dioceses, because as Betsy and I can attest, and as you're a living witness to, Eucharistic adoration truly is a gift to the faithful, and God wants us to spend time with him, and he's there for us. So thank you, Monsignor, for alerting us to this worthwhile endeavor, and we will be praying for its success. And thank you for joining us.
Lord Jesus is the heart of the world. I'll see you there.
Thank you, Monsignor.
Thanks, Monsignor.
Thank you. See you next week.
And now, Betsy Ventress spoke with Bronwyn McShea all about women in the church as we look forward to a big conference taking place at the University of Notre Dame next month.
Welcome to Conversations with Consequences. Today, we are thrilled to have author and historian Dr. Bronwyn McShea. Dr. McShea's scholarship focuses on early modern European history and the history of Catholicism from later medieval to modern times. She has a distinguished academic pedigree, with 2 degrees from Harvard and a PhD in history from Yale. She has held numerous academic positions and fellowships, and this spring, she is the 2025 Teilhard de Chardin Fellow in Catholic Studies at Loyola University in Chicago. She's the author of numerous articles and essays, and also 3 books. Most recently, and a favorite of mine, Women of the Church, What Every Catholic Should Know. Welcome to the show.
Hi there, Betsy. Thanks for having me on.
Before we delve into the book, if you don't mind if I ask a personal question,
sure. Okay.
Tell us about your first name, Bronwyn.
Yes, my first name, Bronwyn, which I, as a child, I was a bit ambivalent about, comes from, there's a novel written by a Welsh author, Richard Llewellyn. My mother was reading this novel, How Green Is My Valley, when I was on the way, shall we say. And so she just fell in love with the name. Bronwyn is a minor character, I think, in the story, but she's sort of a special character in the story. And I think my parents were down to Bronwyn and maybe Natasha after a Tolstoy character. So I'm kind of glad my mother won out in this regard. So yeah, it was sort of a name I had to grow into. It gets me in trouble sometimes because people don't know what to do when they see the combination of letters there.
Well, so. I love the John Ford movie. You know, he was the great Catholic movie director who used to make people on set go to mass or fly priests in and by helicopter. So I loved reading that very fun part of your story.
Sure.
So tell us about your childhood in Cornwall, New York, and especially, did you go to Catholic school, and what was your obviously love books. So tell us about what got you interested in reading.
For the most part, did not go to Catholic school. It was expensive to go to Catholic school. So my siblings and I went to public school. Mm-hmm. My father, a longtime New York City construction worker, my mom, stay-at-home mother, are both bookworms. So I grew up in a house just full of books, and they're still all there in the family house. And my parents were like, "What? Where are these going to go?" So I grew up, especially with history books, biographies, encyclopedias, old National Geographic magazines, everything. I was surrounded by knowledge, and I just loved pouring through these books. And we also grew up watching a lot of old films. So my imagination was just sort of fired up with history from an early age. And so I kind of knew I wanted to do history when I got to college, although I thought I was going to become a lawyer and make money after that was over. But I just, history just kept calling me to it in a way that felt very vocational, I would say. So.
And did you read?
I do thank my parents for a lot of that. I think they sort of set me on that path, maybe unintentionally. They weren't necessarily trying to turn me into a little historian.
Did you read saint stories growing up? Was that part
I
of that?
I did. I can't say I read as many as maybe films like the Song of Bernadette or the Brother, Son, Sister, Moon. Like some of the films that were made, we watched. I was very much aware of various saints, but often through either stories my mother would tell me. She told me about Catherine of Siena. We'd watch EWTN and, you know, Catholic TV sometimes. And so I would get a sense from there. But I can't say that I was steeped in the lives of the saints in the way that my parents certainly had been when they were growing up, sort of in the 50s and 60s. So
sure. That's really interesting. So the history was there from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And I want to turn to the book, but before I do want to highlight one thing, that you're going to be a featured speaker at a conference at the University of Notre Dame, March 26th through 28th. The title of the conference, which really fits in well with our show today, True Genius, The Mission of Women in Church and Culture. And your talk specifically will be The Feminine Genius and Catholic History. And I'll be there, and some of my co-hosts will be there. And I hope that they'll be filming it for anybody who listens to our show that might not be able to go there. I think that would be a great thing for them to tap into that. So
it'll be great to see you there.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking forward to it. And it says that you're going to be celebrating the feminine genealogy of the faith and looking at the riches of the faith and reading the signs of the times. And so that really fits in to your book, Women in the Church, What Every Catholic Should Know. And there are six glorious chapters of famous and obscure Catholic women. And you start with the Blessed Mother and end with Mother Teresa and the missionaries in the Global South. 363 women and groups that we should all know. So in the back of the book, I just wanted to say that Professor Robert George at Princeton says, there's a myth that the Catholic Church is an institution of, by, and for men. The brilliant Bronwyn McShay explodes that myth. And so when you set out to do this, did you think women are so underrepresented in history? Or tell us about the germination of this, which maybe you should start with that really poignant little piece about being in Assisi at the beginning of the book.
Sure. Yeah. I begin with an anecdote. I was with a friend in Assisi some years ago, not that many years ago, but and we were given a tour by one of the friars there, San Damiano, where Claire and her sisters were nuns. And I didn't have any special devotion to St. Clare of Assisi. I mean, I knew about her story going into this, but we had the sort of tour all to ourselves, and we went by this kind of stone area, and the friar told us that that was where St. Clare and the first poor Clares did their laundry. And then we sat down also at a table that was sort of the refectory table. And I just was very overcome by just the ordinariness of these spaces, and just thinking of this sort of giant of the faith, right? One of the foundresses of one of the great orders, was just like me and my mom doing laundry or something like that. I was just very hit by how the ordinariness of even the great saints. And so I've always been drawn to kind of wanting to put into everyday context figures that are larger than life. And so I was actually sort of through a conversation, I was essentially asked to write a book for the series, What Every Catholic Should Know, that's co-published by Ignatius and the Augustine Institute. And it's a series that's growing, and each volume focuses on one area of Catholic theology or culture or learning or something. And so it's kind of an introductory volume on all sorts of subjects. So mine, I believe, is the only one that's kind of more historical. But I wanted to do one on women. And there was sort of a initial thought that we would make this kind of the key saints every Catholic should know. But it occurred to me there are many people out there who've written good volumes, like Lives of the Saints collections. And I'm a historian, and I kind of bring certain things to the table that I wanted to sort of put to the advantage of this book. And among them is that just through my historical study, I've been exposed to a tremendous amount of history about contributions of Catholic women who are not necessarily canonized, or in some cases even beatified, in some cases aren't even that holy, but are very important for understanding the church's history, like Maria Theresa of Austria or certain Irene of Athens, who called together the Second Council of Nicaea.
And okay, was she the one that
women of the church?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, Irene. I was just just going over that story this morning, and she did some bad things to people in her family.
Yeah, well, I like to sort of, there's a tendency, I think, among the Catholic historical tradition is very focused on hagiography, the lives of the saints. And so we like to point out right. the virtue and all the good they did. But I like to say all our saints were sinners, right? The only sinless person is the Blessed Mother.
Yeah.
And some of us are greater sinners than others and are not going to be canonized as saints, right? Irene of Athens lived in a rather brutal time. She was Empress of the Byzantine Empire. The church was really torn apart quite violently over the iconoclasm crisis. And she favored the side that favored images, the use of images in worship. And so there was a big dynastic struggle going on between people around her and people around her son, who technically was the rightful heir. The son was a sort of associated with iconoclasts and this kind of difficult moment in the church. So I'm not promoting her for sanctity by any means.
Yeah, you just want to tell us what she did.
She had her son blinded, yes, and right. she deposed her own son, and she held on to power. And so the church, I like to sometimes complicate people's picture a little bit. The church owes a rather important ecumenical council that still to this day is acknowledged by East and West.
To Irene
of Athens, as well yes. as the bishops involved. And that's the kind of woman in Catholic history that I feel like we're just not told about women like this sometimes for whatever reason, but they played central parts in the history of the church in different periods. And so right. I include them with all these great saints like Teresa of Avila, other doctors of the church,
right?
And just women that help illustrate the times, not just the personal sanctity of this or that person. So.
And that leads me to one of the other people I wanted you to talk about, which was Clotilde, who, is that how you say her name?
Clotilde, I guess.
Clotilde. And will you tell us the story? Because she was married to a pagan, and she's really instrumental to the history of France.
Yes. We don't have a ton of information about her, but she was the queen of King Clovis, who's the founder of the... basically, I think the Merovingian dynasty of Frankish first kings of the kingdom that eventually became France. And in the 6th century, I'm blanking on the exact date, it's in my book, she was a Christian. Clovis was a pagan. She, for many years, urged him to convert to Christianity and have their children baptized and raised as Christians. He resisted. Eventually, he converts, and the kingdom that becomes France in is one of the first Christian kingdoms in Western Europe, in large measure due I would say, to Clotilde's patience and prodding, her mix of these two things. So, I mean, we don't have, again, too much information, but she's a figure that she's been honored as a saint certainly in the French tradition for centuries. A lot of Catholics just aren't taught about women like this in sort of the dark ages that were very important in the Christianization of Europe.
Right. So another French woman that I was a little surprised to see in the book was Marie Antoinette. Yes. We're just thinking about let them eat cake and, sure, off with their heads. So tell us why and what her redeeming virtues are or were, right, in your mind.
And again, that's not necessarily my goal, is to show her redeeming virtues by including her. I include her because I believe she's one of the most famous Catholic women in history, and Catholics should know about her.
Right.
As a woman of the church, she was a devout Catholic. I think she got more devout over time. Mm-hmm. She was the daughter of Maria Theresa of Austria, one of the most powerful Catholics of the 18th century period. She was queen, of course, at the time the French Revolution ends up toppling the French monarchy, and she's executed. Her children are taken from her.
Yeah.
She spent her final days, after having the most kind of glorious courtly lifestyle a person could have, she spent her final days in a prison cell in the center of Paris with just, I think, one or two holy books, and saying prayers and seeing a priest on occasion. And there's a tradition among I would say a minority of French Catholics of seeing Marie Antoinette and King Louis XVI as martyrs for the church. The Catholic Church doesn't honor them as saints, but I just thought she should be included, partly because, she helps illustrate what's happening to the church at her time and where the leading Catholic women of her time generally were falling on that side of the divide that's happening.
Right. Interesting. So, in the introduction, or pardon me, the foreword, Patricia Snow says that one of the things that she noticed with all of the women that you feature is the two words that came out were relational and receptive. Mm-hmm. Did you think about that as you wrote the book, that these women all are people? Well, I mean, I think it's a little hard for people to relate to Marie Antoinette, but I guess she was relational.
I like the foods that she would have eaten. So anyway, I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
How did you feel about that she mentioned that in the foreword? Did you feel that was really captured some of what you were trying to do?
Yes, I wouldn't say I was consciously trying to do that. I really take my vocation as a historian seriously, and my job, simple as it is simply to say what happened. And if women are an important part of that story, I'm going to say what they did. So in terms of kind of analyzing their virtue or their sanctity or what aspect of their life kind of stands out the most, I invited Patricia Snow to write the foreword, partly so she could tell me some of the things that were standing out to her, because I highly respect her. She has a very theologically inflected way of thinking and analyzing even literature. So I wanted to hear her, what she saw standing out from my own text, because as a historian, I could get a bit lost in the details. So I would say with some cases, I certainly was thinking of those virtues as important,
sure,
the way I described certain women, but I was not sort of consciously trying to kind of use history to push that idea in any way.
Right. And I love the whole receptivity thing, because of course that really is kind of at the heart of the genius of the feminine, right? That there's just these people that really understand people differently than men. And one of the really fascinating parts about the book is where you talk about how these women worked with men. Of course, St. Catherine of Siena is known for all of her dealings with the papal controversy in Avignon. Would you tell us a little bit about St. Marcella and St. Jerome, who, of course, was the author of the Vulgate version of the Bible?
Yes. So St. Marcella of Rome, she was older than St. Jerome. She was a pious widow, and she and a number of kind of pious matrons of Rome. By matron, I don't mean older woman. I mean an upper class kind of patrician woman who were Christian. They sort of began to study scripture together, to help the poor. They were living sort of like the first nuns in a way, although I don't know if we can call them that. She was friends with St. Jerome. They spoke a lot about the meaning of scripture. Jerome, of course, is famous for translating the Bible into Latin. And St. Jerome himself mentions her in his letters. He wrote some of his letters to her. And he said that she was one of the most, her ability to understand scripture was beyond most people's, and that he trusted her. Like when he left Rome, he trusted her that if there was a dispute over the meaning of scripture, to ask Marcella of Rome what she thought. So she had played this leaderly role, even in a teaching way. And St. Jerome fully endorsed this. In fact, he encouraged the idea. Uh-huh. So I think there are episodes like that with the church fathers who sometimes get painted with a broad brushstroke by certain feminist historians as kind of misogynistic because of certain things they say here and there. There are plenty of episodes of the church fathers highly respecting certain women and promoting their leadership in different ways. So I wanted to point that out.
I love that. I love that all through the book, you see women working with men and the men admiring and respecting and really listening to them and taking their advice. And so when we go into the 20th century, did you have any favorites? I mean, there's a lot of medieval, there's a lot in early, but coming into the 20th century and even into the 21st century, do you have some people that you maybe didn't know a lot about that you were fascinated by?
There's so many that I got sort of caught up with as I was writing about them. I would say someone like St. Adelaide of Italy. She was the first Holy Roman Empress to be consecrated. She was a very important, she helped patronize monasteries. She helped the Cluniac reform alongside her husband, the Holy Roman Emperor Otto. Mm-hmm. Someone like that just fascinated me because I didn't know too much about her. And so I wish I could have done a deeper dive than I did. But I would actually say the figures that stood out the most to me in a way that surprised me were all the 19th century female foundresses of new congregations, some of the first female missionary congregations, even before Mother Cabrini did so. Some of the women who were active in missions or hospital work or establishing schools for the poor in war-torn parts of Europe or other. I think the legacy of 19th century nuns is really underappreciated. We sort of have this image, many of us, of kind of, it's seen as sort of this old-fashioned time when maybe they were being told what to do by clergymen too much or something. That is not at all the case. They worked with a lot of clergymen. They were businesswomen. They were entrepreneurs. They were holy and devoted to the poor. There's so many of them. I can't even name one that really stands out, but I was really struck by the legacy of 19th century nuns and foundresses also of secular institutes that are more kind of in the world, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think that a lot more history could still be done there. And there are plenty of historical scholars kind of doing good work on more specific figures out there. But
And you write about women in the global South. That's mm-hmm. also at the very end of your book. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I wanted the book to be as global as I could make it while still based on scholarship that's out there. And I wanted to make sure there was a section on how global the church has become by the 21st century. And
right.
I could only select a few stories. So I wanted to highlight match the beginning of the book where we have stories of martyrs in the early church.
Right.
And I pointed out to several incidents of martyrdoms in kind of war-torn areas of the world where you have some tensions between Muslims and Christians or groups, different groups like that. And so there are several martyred Sisters of Charity of Mother Teresa's order that I mentioned. And I just want to make sure people are aware
right.
of some of modern day episodes that are very similar in some ways to the early church episodes.
Yes. Now, I wanted to just say that at the very end of your book, we could talk all day about this book, but I wanted to say something that I thought was a great way to close. I asked my readers to be mindful, you wrote, that each woman covered in this book was and remains, even if she is in heaven, as human as Claire of Assisi was when eating bread and soup or making sure laundry was on schedule. Mm-hmm. So what you're trying to tell us, really, Bronwyn, that sanctity is for everyone.
Yes. And human beings, when you're a saint, you're still very human. So,
thank yes. you so much for joining us. And we hope that all of our listeners will buy your books and learn as much as we did. And everyone look up that conference at Notre Dame where Bronwyn will be the featured speaker. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. Thank you.
And we'd like to thank all of our guests and listeners for joining us today. Make sure to follow us on social media. And as always, you go with our prayers.